Welcome to the conference room with this week's guest, Matthew Andriani.
Everyone working from home through VPN services can't work from home. All your employees are stuck doing nothing. If you've got insurance agents in the field and you're an insurance company, you've got thousands of agents in the field, and your IT services come down, none of your agents can work. No one can update their insurance policy.
Welcome to The Conference Room, a weekly podcast where business leaders and growth experts kindly share their experiences, actionable tips, and secrets to successfully grow a business. If you like the podcast, don't forget to subscribe and leave us a five-star review. It'll really help us out. And I really hope you enjoy this week's episode. I'm Simon Lader. Welcome to The Conference Room. Good afternoon and welcome to The Conference Room. I'm joined today by Matthew Andriani. He's the founder and CEO of cybersecurity vendor Mazebolt. He holds two US patents for non-disruptive DDoS testing, and he built his career in technical, professional services, and security research positions with companies such as Checkpoint Software, Corrigan, and Radware, where he built their emergency response teams before founding Mazebolt, where he currently serves as their CEO. And I'm delighted to say that he's found time to come in and talk to us here in the conference room. So, Matthew Andriani, good afternoon and welcome to the conference room.
Good afternoon, Simon. Good to see you again. And thank you for that very kind introduction and very welcoming introduction. I'm happy to be here and hope we can have a good conversation.
I'm sure we will. Thank you so much for being here. So, every hero has an origin story and you're the hero of our story. So, tell me, how did you get from just starting out through your education to becoming the CEO of cybersecurity vendor Mazebolt?
So it was not a short journey. As you mentioned, I started off in Checkpoint. I had a good period in Checkpoint, which is a well-known cybersecurity company in Israel and worldwide, actually. I then went into another startup where we worked on image recognition at the time, and we were one of the first kind of companies that were able to recognize an image within an image, and this had good application for copyright infringement and stuff like that. I really enjoyed the experience of that kind of entrepreneurship. It was a four-man company that eventually got acquired by eBay. But following that, about a year later, I joined Radware as a researcher, as a security researcher. I loved security. I went back into security. I got offered a great job there where there was this new research lab that was looking at IPS systems, malware research, and DDoS. And as time evolved in that team, it focused mainly on the DDoS threat. And this was kind of the direction that team went in. It was a very small team of also four or five guys again. So this kind of entrepreneurial spirit in a large corporate. And by the time I left, we had built it up to 30, 35 people. And after that, through my time in seeing large organizations being affected by these real-time attacks, whereas what that emergency response team eventually landed up doing, we were responding to attacks that bypassed the security protections of the Radware technology, which, by the way, all the vendors had the same issue. It wasn't just Radware. Mm-hmm. So sometimes the technology didn't work as expected. So you had to have this team come in and kind of reconfigure in real time while the damage was happening and stop this attack. And we're talking attacks on, like, you know, the New York Stock Exchange, the Hong Kong Stock Exchange, PayPal, the largest banks like JP Morgan, Chase. You know, these were large organizations being hit by these attacks with the best technology deployed to prevent these attacks. Radware had probably the best emergency response team in the world at the time. And these attacks were just going through and damaging these organizations significantly, where online services for their customers were just unavailable.
Right.
So that's how it all started. Seeing that is what was kind of the seeds. It was planting the seeds of what would eventually become Mazebolt.
Okay, great stuff. So we're going to talk about Mazebot in just a second, but I'd like to kind of dig into how you determined that there was a real problem that needed solving and how you went about solving. And obviously, you just kind of touched on it a little bit in terms of what the emergency response teams were doing at Radware. But just for the people that don't necessarily have a strong technical background, such as myself, tell me, what exactly is a DDoS attack? And why doesn't or didn't the technology at the time provide adequate protection for the JP Morgans and the PayPals and the stock exchanges of the world at the time, and perhaps even now?
So I think, first, let's clarify what a DDoS attack is.
Yes.
A DDoS attack is an attack that's designed to overwhelm the resources of an online service. Meaning, think about it, if you've got like three car lanes, but you need to put 10 cars through those three lanes, if all 10 go at the same time, there's going to be an accident and no one's going to get through. So right. That's kind of like how DDoS works, but it can happen on various levels of technology. But essentially what the attackers are doing is they're tying up online resources like online banking, gaming, online trading, gaming in terms of fun gaming, arcade gaming, or gambling, or right. anything that relies on online productivity, like eBay is a good example.
Right.
So what a DDoS attack would do is make eBay unavailable, or it would make your online bank unavailable. Whatever the service is, it would be unavailable, meaning your customers cannot use that product. If you need to execute a trade in your bank, you can't do that. If you've got a trading platform and you can't do that. If you think about a bank coming under attack, if they get successfully DDoS attacked, everyone working from home through VPN services can't work from home. All your employees are stuck doing nothing. If you've got insurance agents in the field and you're an insurance company, and you've got thousands of agents in the field and your IT services come down, none of your agents can work. No one can update their insurance policy. So
this is all from there being, as I understand it, there's a certain amount of, for want of a better term, like traffic lanes going in and out of the bank, the insurance company, the gaming company, whatever it is. And the attackers just overwhelm and bombard them with traffic. So that right. There's just basically a traffic jam on every entry and exit point into that organization, so that legitimate people, the customers, the employees, whatever, just can't get in.
Correct. Right. Correct. And if you think about it, it could also be that not just the lanes going in. Once you're actually in, you could actually start jamming up different rooms, if you think about it like that. Like wow. You could start. So there's a misconception sometimes that DDoS is just this massive attack that takes your services down. But very often those attacks are not massive, but they still take your services down because they're smarter and they know how to maximize the resource usage of the services that are serving public services. For instance, let's just assume you had a search page on a website, which is kind of an easy thing. If you did a million queries on that page, it's not a lot of traffic, but it's an incredible amount of work that the service needs to do to serve a million different queries.
Right.
So that's getting a little bit too technical. But the point is this. DDoS stops online connectivity. It stops online business productivity. And when you come out, and another important aspect is that if you, like a bank, and you've got multiple satellite locations and your head office comes under attack, you may lose security management of all those locations too. So you kind of go dark at the same time. So if you come under an attack, you don't really know what's going on anymore. And what our team in Radware did at the time was, as you said, how come these organizations were still being damaged by these attacks, even though they had deployed all this technology and these defenses to protect them? And that's because the attackers understood that, like all technology, it can be bypassed. But with DDoS, it was relatively easy to bypass because to configure DDoS protection is very complicated. It's a complicated attack to stop. Relatively simple to launch, quite complicated to stop, because you've got to look at the bad traffic and find where the bad traffic is without stopping the good traffic. Otherwise, you kind of block everybody and no one can use it. The point of the protection is to kind of figure out who's the bad and the good. And what we found was, in different environments, that's quite challenging to do because there isn't a one-size-fits-all. And that's why you had to establish this team that when the technology does fail to automatically mitigate it, you need to in real time go and kind of reconfigure all the protection to block that attack. And if attack next time by that, then that's not going to get through. And seeing so many, keep in mind, all of the damage that I saw, I only saw the damage that was happening from these attacks. They didn't come through to our team if everything was okay.
Right.
We only dealt with these damaging attacks. So when you've seen, you know, 100 plus of these kind of scenarios with some of the largest organizations and governments in the world, you realize there's a serious problem. If you've got like the cutting edge DDoS protection, which I believe at the time Radware was the cutting edge technology, not just because I worked there, they really had great technology, far superior. In fact, they fueled some of the other large vendors at the time. The technology behind the scenes fueled some of their actually some of their competitors. So they really did have the kind of the leading technology at the time. And even so, their customers were being damaged very, very frequently. And again, I don't want to pick on Radware because it was across the board. But it was obvious that there's a major problem here. When you're sitting in a massive bank and they've invested millions of dollars in protection, and you see all those online services stopping, which was happening frequently during an operation called Operation Ababil in 2012, you realize that there's a major problem, and why wasn't this stopped before? How can this happen? And I think even, you know, large organizations are surprised when that happens to them, when they've invested so much in that protection.
So having identified that there's a real problem, mm-hmm. how did you? I'm curious to understand how you went about solving it, or identifying that it was a problem that could be solved, right? And then how you turn that into an enterprise product around which you could build a company. So talk me through that process. First of all, how you determined it was actually a problem that could be solved, and then how you went about turning the solution, or even the concept of a solution, into a product around which you could build a company.
So every time one of these attacks, or not every time, let's say the 95 percentile of the times that these attacks occurred, that the customers were damaged, it was clear that with very easy configuration changes, this could have been completely prevented. Like serious amounts of damage, had you known what needed to be configured, that damage would not have occurred. It's always clear in hindsight and after the fact, but after the fact, it was very clear that this could have been prevented had that been configured. So based on that knowledge and seeing this again and again and again and again, it's like, you know, wash, rinse, repeat, wash, rinse.
Right.
But it was always the same situation. What I did was, I obviously left Radware at the time, and I decided I'm going to start a services company that validates these protections, and thereby, I'm going to validate it better than anybody else, thereby preventing any one of these organizations going down. That was the logic at the time. Mm-hmm. We'll test it. I believe it could be done. I thought, you know, this type of technology has certain protection modules, let's say, inside it. If you check each one of those modules through real attack simulations, you'll be able to theoretically identify the weaknesses in that protection, fix those weaknesses, and if that company is ever attacked, nothing will happen to that company. They won't lose millions or tens of millions of dollars in damages because of something that could have been completely prevented. So, like all entrepreneurs, I think, you know, you're convinced that you've got the best, it's going to work. So we started, me and another founder started a services company. We started building this, essentially a DDoS platform, but to test enterprises. So this platform we managed to develop in around 8 months. The first version was working in about 8 months. And we were getting great results. So we got our first customer, was a payment provider, a payment processor. They had a lot of DDoS problems. We said, look, we'll come and test and whatever. We were very happy. We had our first customer and started testing with them. We got great results. We were able to launch 18 attacks in the space of 3 hours, check that everything worked. What didn't work, we said we'll organize another maintenance period and we'll check it again. Keep in mind, to evaluate that environment, you had to have a maintenance period because DDoS by its very nature stops your services. So when you're testing it, you have to stop your online, you have to have a maintenance period because there's a very good chance that while you're trying to evaluate these protections, that your services are going to go down. So you should expect downtime because you have to check production environment. So we were convinced we had the best testing service out there, you know, and we managed to onboard many dozens of customers relatively quickly, all enterprises, government, we were able to onboard. And we were doing this testing. It was a very nice, profitable services business. And then what we started to notice after what we did, again, going back to, there were other companies in the world doing that at the time. We were not unique. We had built a great platform to do this. Let's say 18 months into 2 years, we already had a great platform doing this. And we improved it and made it better. And we had all the attacks and made it better and better reporting and better metrics and whatever. And we were providing real value to our customers. Why? Because number one, we trained their team. When the team, it's called Red Team, DDoS Red Team. When the team had to see this at night, in the maintenance window, they understood what's happening with all their defensive systems, and they understood how to better mitigate attacks that might have gotten through and figure out how they use their controls, how to configure their controls in real time when things have failed, to see how systems work under attack. You can't do that every day, obviously. So that was a great time to train the team. We were also able to close the weak areas that we discovered. So we thought we've done a great job. And we had done it in a way that, again, that we had validated each one of these kind of protection mechanisms. So we thought our edge was our knowledge in the area of DDoS would help most effectively validate that environment in the short maintenance window that you've got, because you don't have a permanent maintenance window. It's very expensive testing. You know, it can range from $10,000 to $30,000 for a few hours. And even more, and
not including loss of productivity during the downtime as well.
Correct. Yeah. And all of the staff on standby in the middle of the night or on a Sunday. I mean, you can imagine a Swiss bank with all of their staff on a Sunday at 3 a.m.
Yeah.
And you know, they're not used to doing that. You know, it's like it's a big event.
Right.
And after we had done all of that, and we were servicing over 100 enterprises after a few years, we still realized we had customers still coming down from damaging DDoS attacks. And some of these customers were using us quite frequently and were really relying on us as an authority to help them prevent this, because they were suffering very badly. I mean, if you're a payment processor and you can't process payments for a supermarket, your business is at serious risk, because if your payment processing doesn't work, I'm going to go to your competitor.
Right. So were they holding you not responsible, but were they basically, you know, when these companies, when your clients were still getting DDoS attacks, were they like, hey, Matthew, what the heck's going on? We thought you guys were meant to be preventing this. Or were they more understanding of, okay, you've stemmed some of the tide, but at the end of the day, you know, where before we were getting, you know, 1,000 attacks, now we're only getting 20, but those 20 are still damaging. How are they responding to still getting attacked?
So I think they were obviously still very upset, under a lot of pressure in those moments, in those particular moments. I think we were more, at least I was more upset. At that time, we were already about 8-9 people. I was very upset that that was happening. I was more upset than them sometimes, I think, that how could this happen after we've got the best method, the largest platform, the, you know, operating off the strictest data sets possible, that, you know, previous data sets guiding us for future tests, really refining. We had the baseline testing methodology and all sorts of methodologies, really using what we could to have the best method possible to evaluate an enterprise environment against DDoS attack. And they're still going down. So I was very upset with the situation. I think sometimes even more than that. I mean, the customers went through a terrible time. Don't get me wrong. When you're under a DDoS attack and you've got a lot of damage, they're pretty upset too. So, but we weren't blamed. We weren't blamed in any way. I think it was kind of accepted. They felt, by the way, that they were closing the gap much quicker at that point, because the team was quicker. The response was quicker. People were more comfortable with the controls on what to do in the situation. But they were still suffering half an hour, sometimes a few hours of intermittent downtime. So,
as opposed to what would have been several hours a day or two in the past, or?
Yeah, several hours. It could have been, you know, several hours of complete downtime, not even intermittent, complete downtime.
So it was still so even though they were still suffering some damage, it was nowhere near as bad as it otherwise would have been. So they were still seeing some value, but obviously the ideal was it not happening at all, but we weren't quite there yet.
Correct.
Right, okay.
And what dawned on me at the time, which is what was a major shift in the company around 2017, 2018, around there, was we are not actually evaluating how effective the DDoS protection is at all. What we're really doing now is we're checking the team and how effective the team is at responding to a damaging attack. Because when you look at the number of entry points an attacker can actually take into the environment, what you realize is that you're checking 18 in 3 hours, where there may be 5 to 10,000 potential entry points. And every time a customer came down, you always realized it was something you didn't validate. It wasn't checked. You didn't think you would do that. And that led to the concept of, is it possible to evaluate all of the DDoS protection and every potential entry point that's known, and without creating a maintenance window? So we started researching and working on that. And we thought theoretically that it is possible. So we straight away filed IP in the area. And later on, we started, we then went and got letters of intent from a few customers. He said, you know, will the market really accept such a product, that we're going to be essentially non-disruptively DDoS attacking you in a non-disruptive manner, to find those potential DDoS vulnerabilities to get through before an attacker can exploit that.
Right.
Will people tolerate that? Because no one had done that before. Because conventional wisdom said, if you want to validate for DDoS attacks, you have to have downtime. You have to have a maintenance period. And what we were going to be going, theoretically, to the market, telling people, look, to solve this problem and make sure you never have a damaging attack, you have to close these things that no one knew about at the time, called DDoS vulnerabilities. And the way we're going to do that is we're going to DDoS attack you all the time. So we needed to get some people to buy into this concept.
And do that without any downtime?
On the technological side, yes, do it. But first, you've got to get people to buy into the product concept.
Yeah.
And number one, do you think this will deliver value to you if it's possible? And would you be willing to sign up and pay for such a service?
Right.
I mean, you really want to know that. So straight away, I went out and got a couple of letters of intent that one of them happened to be a very important government entity, and another one was a payment processor that we had worked with for a long time. And both were heavily targeted customers. So I figured these would be prime candidates to do an alpha version, and maybe they're a little bit more willing to try this type of technology. And once we got that agreement, that tacit agreement, we began to develop an MVP product. But that took significant amount of time. Even in our lab, it took over a year with quite a few people working on it. Because we had to ensure that there was no chance of any downtime to the production environment we were evaluating.
Wow.
Which was a big challenge by itself.
Yeah.
So remember, we're going to be doing non-disruptive DDoS attacks against your production environment during production hours, and you're a payment processor. So you can't say, sorry, there's a mistake, and have a little bit of an account management call. Oops. Yeah, the oops isn't going to cut, right? Oops isn't good. So I don't know if you know, Simon, and I'm sure you're very familiar with it, but in many areas of software in general, not just security, people are willing to tolerate bugs. You have a bug, you have a bug there. In our area, no one is willing to tolerate a bug, right? No one's going to say, it's okay, you DDoSed me and you took me down by mistake. Sorry to hear you had that bug.
But air traffic control, people are have zero tolerance, very low tolerance of mistakes in air traffic control or parachute maintenance. There's certain things where 99.9% isn't good enough. It needs to work all the time, right?
Correct. Correct. And that's very, very similar to what the situation we're in, because right. We're operating on production all the time with gaming companies, with governments, with banks, with insurance companies. And all of these kind of companies and organizations, they just can't have a mistake. You can't, not in that area of the product. So just so I understand this.
So effectively what you were at that point attempting to do was right. to have the technology effectively stage, for want of a better term, kind of safe, simulated DDoS attacks that would show whether or not a DDoS attack could happen without actually causing the damage that a DDoS attack would ordinarily do, which Correct. Is why it could be done during like real normal working hours rather than at 2 a.m. on a Saturday morning.
Correct.
Wow.
Exactly. Okay. And what it gave and what that capability gives you is it gives you the coverage. Remember, I mentioned you've got thousands of these entry points.
Right.
So it was very clear that the only way to completely prevent a damaging attack is you need to know what entry points are actually open to various attack vectors.
By doing an attack.
By doing an attack.
Right.
By triggering the protections that are protecting that service.
Right.
And without doing that, you actually are completely blind as to if that's working.
Right.
You have no idea. You actually have no idea. Someone can tell you, yes, sure, it's working. We saw that in less than 30% of the cases, when we did in the old testing that we used to do, when we did find a vulnerability in that attack surface, in less than 30% of the cases, they actually were able to fix it the first time. It normally took 2 and 3 iterations before the vendor actually got it right, because it's so complicated to fine tune.
Right.
So you needed this ongoing attack. So we started QAing it, developing this MVP. Really, it wasn't even an MVP. At that time, it was an MVP / alpha version, which we were actually doing on the weakest possible equipment to make sure that everything was as sensitive as possible in the system. Okay. So that we knew, that we were almost doing simulations against an old home laptop running a web server. and making sure that that web server was never affected and that that home router was never affected and the technology still ran and was able to evaluate those DDoS protections. When we were comfortable that we got it to that level, that nothing was affected, we then went back, which took over a year to do. We then went back to those people who had signed the letter of intent and said, guess what, we're ready. So now we're going to start deploying. And amazingly, since then, touchwood, there has never been any issue with regards to the non-disruptive nature of the product. It worked beautifully. In fact, it worked so well, I thought we had a bug at the beginning because we got so many vulnerabilities coming in that we then found ourselves with a whole new different challenge, which I'll get into. But we were able to evaluate so much so quickly, and the number of vulnerabilities we saw, I was convinced there's a bug here. Well, are we missing something? It turned out all the data was correct, which we validated in maintenance pairs with actually attacking what we had identified with radar, with actually attacking it at the beginning stages in maintenance pairs with cooperation with the customer.
Radar being the product.
Radar being what was this new kind of product.
Right.
We didn't have a name at that time. I think we called it non-disruptive testing. Which today is called radar. And once we found the vulnerabilities, we had an agreement with the customer that we would validate this in a maintenance period to see that actually everything is accurate, that awesome. And it was one-to-one, really just one-to-one. And we did this in two customers. We took around another year of that period of doing all of this, which was a kind of a late alpha slash beta phase of the product. And eventually, after more than 4 years of development and alpha beta testing, early 2021, we released the product to the public. We actually got another beta customer there. And since then, we've onboarded many, many dozens of customers, enterprises, and we are successfully really identifying and removing an incredible amount of vulnerabilities across the board. So we have worked with all the major vendors now. We've got better relationships with some of them and not as good relationships with others. But because what this required was quite a shift in the vendor in the mitigation vendor thinking. Because until that point, no one had really figured out how to evaluate DDoS protection. It hadn't been evaluated.
What were they doing beforehand? How would you compare before to what's possible now?
Well, first of all, they were doing the traditional testing, red team testing, which required these maintenance pairs. But again, that didn't really improve the protection in any meaningful way. It was negligible. You can test less than 1% of the attack surface.
Right.
So it was really negligible, but it did check the team. What they did and are doing, if you don't have a product like what we do, is you're essentially waiting around for a damaging attack to happen and then enacting these response teams and SLAs with intelligent human responses or smart human responses, but essentially waiting for a human response to kick in if the automated protection fails. So the industry as a whole, the DDoS industry as a whole, what happened is they normalized that damaging attacks are a fact of DDoS. You have to first be damaged, we'll then come in, fix it, and then next time you won't be damaged. So, but that's, by the way, that's what's still available today. If you don't have something like radar running, that is the modus operandi. That's what
amazing. It's amazing to me that that would be considered a normal way. I mean, it's a little bit like saying, well, we've got no idea whether or not our house is safe from a fire. So what we'll do is we'll just wait until a fire breaks out, call the fire department, they'll put it out, and then we'll know, right, that over there we shouldn't leave, you know, the oven on for 400 degrees before we go to bed. I mean, it just seems really almost bizarre that the industry would tolerate this approach to, rather than being proactive and trying to stop anything damaging happening, that we'll just wait until damage happens and react to it. It's very odd that that's...
I'm in full agreement with you. And I think one of the very interesting things, one of the things we initially faced, and going back to when we originally started with the radar product in early 21, actually before that, but even with our alpha customers, what happened was we found another very big problem. When we took these vulnerabilities to a vendor, keep in mind, they had never seen such a report. They'd never seen such a report. No one's ever evaluated their technology in production. Mm-hmm. Right? No one had ever done that to them. So now all of a sudden they get this report. First, they've got to kind of get to, you know, make sense of what they're looking at. What is this? Once they understand what they're looking at, a new understanding comes that now someone has to fix this. And who has to fix this? And now you know about a problem that can damage your customer. You're not going to ignore that. Right? Right. Although you'd be surprised, some vendors have tried to do that. Right. And the reason is because it now requires the protection vendor, the mitigation vendor, to actually take significant steps to patch those systems.
Right.
Which, imagine, right now, you're an organization, you've got a customer every year, your customer, you know, you're renewing your contract with your bank, you provide them protection, you're renewing your contract with them. And once in a while, there could be a very bad event that's an unusual event, which we found out is not so unusual when you're attacked. In this unusual event, there'll be this response team that comes, helps you out, and, you know, we solved the problem. That's what was normalized in the industry. Now we come along and say, well, actually, all of that could have been completely prevented. No one had to have their services down for 3 or 4 hours or, you know, intermittent downtime for a couple of days. No one had to have that. We can identify everything beforehand. You can come and configure everything, and no downtime is going to happen if attacked. It will all automatically work. So now there was this whole amount of work that had to be done that never had to be done prior. And actually, interestingly enough, one of the top vendors in the market, one of the top guys at the vendors, told me, look, you're disrupting our business model. He was actually quite upset. You know, when one of these reports come through, we've got to take care of all of that. I said, yeah, sure. You know, for me, it was obvious. But I realized that there was this initial kickback by many, many of the vendors, and some of which I had very good relationships with before, which had to be overcome. So we worked closely with them. We, you know, now 2.5 years later, we've actually gotten to a point that it's become clear that that vulnerability data, if you ignore it, you're essentially putting your organization, or if they're your customer, at risk. Mm-hmm. You're taking an unnecessary risk.
Right.
And one of the vendors that actually recognized this and recognized that, you know, we better be taking this seriously was F5. F5 said, you know, we obviously worked with them. We had a good relationship with them. And our customers were providing these reports, and F5, like every other vendor, was quite surprised when they got the initial report. But they actually said, you know, we're going to solve these issues. And as time went on, they said, you know, we realize that when this vulnerability data gets fed through, we need to change our internal systemic procedures to be able to deal with this and change how we operate, to be able to maintain persistent configurations per customer.
Right.
And they actually took quite a long time, I'd say roughly a year, to realign those internal procedures. And once that had been done, we actually formally announced that F5 is a preferred remediation vendor for DDoS vulnerabilities, because they took the time to do that. We've got other very good relationships in the market that they do that too. But F5 was the only one that actually made those systemic changes to deal with that kind of incoming vulnerability data flow.
Right.
And that obviously gives you a tremendous advantage as an organization, because the reason you have DDoS protection in the first place is to avoid a damaging attack.
Right.
And the only way you can have a damaging attack is by not closing those vulnerabilities once you've got DDoS protection, obviously.
Yeah.
Once you've got Akamai or Amazon Advanced Shield or Azure DDoS protection, or you know, Google Armor or Radware or Imperva, whoever the vendor might be, Verizon, AT&T, it doesn't really matter who the vendor is. But the only way you as a customer can suffer a damaging DDoS attack is because there was a vulnerability in that protection. You don't see AT&T going down or Amazon going down or Akamai going down. What you see is the customer going, well, how did that happen? How did it happen once you've got the protection?
Right.
And the only way it happens is not because of these massive attacks that are, you know, force majeure events or, you know, happen once a year. It's because there was a vulnerability in that protection that a DDoS vulnerability is when that attack vector was not detected towards a target in your organization, slipped through and took down your online services. And that's how it happens. The only way to prevent that is to have that vulnerability data and continuously configure your environment to avoid that attack ever getting.
Right. That's fascinating. That's absolutely fascinating. That's really fascinating. So I want to shift gears for just a moment, because I was really, really kind of interested by when you were talking about the evolution from the services element of what you were doing to developing the product. And over, you know, it took, I think you said, a couple of years before you had like the alpha product ready. And then another couple of years before the, you know, the beta product was ready, you had the letters of intent. Okay. To me, when you identified that it was a problem that you felt was able to be solved, to then have within 12, 18 months, a workable minimal viable product, that's an extraordinary feat of execution, okay? Right. Talk me through, if you would, what happened over that 18-month period, okay? From how you determined, you know, the various pieces of the puzzle in terms of the people that you needed to bring in or the roles that you needed to have filled, how you identified the people that you needed, and how you built the team that, either from sort of internal or external resources, how you built the team that within an 18-month, two-year period had an alpha product that you were able to actually go to those first couple of customers and demonstrate that there was at least something here that was working. So talk me through that period of execution.
So, okay, that's, I'd say that's, you know, one of the challenges that any founder would face, CEO faces, when you shift your company to a different direction, how are you going to do that? So we had built a very successful services company that we had a nice base of enterprises. We had serviced well over 100 enterprises by that point worldwide with our DDoS testing service. And many of them were recurring customers. So we had that kind of support in terms of financial support. We also had investors that backed us. So this is kind of pre-radar, pre the 2021, the shift, even though the shift decision was kind of made before that, but pre the actual, in 2021, at the beginning of 2021, we actually cut all services, and either the customers came to the new product or, well, unfortunately, we had to part way.
So basically, in early 2021, you said, we are no longer a services company. We're not going to take another dime.
This was very tough.
We're absolutely all in a software vendor.
Correct.
Wow, that's a ballsy move.
Yes, that was after many years of building up a nice customer base deciding that we're going to shift.
What was let's just focus on this for just a second. What was the reasoning behind doing that as opposed to saying, okay, because I'm sure you considered doing this, as opposed to saying, okay, let's keep our services revenue coming because that's almost guaranteed revenue month in, month out, quarter in, quarter out, and build up a separate line of business of the software business. Why did you choose to do this complete shift and effectively turn off the services delivery and the services revenue and go all in on being a software company? What was the reasoning behind doing only that instead of maintaining both?
Okay. So to say that I arrived at that decision overnight wouldn't be accurate. There was a lot of debate with myself, debate with some of the board, some of my founder, one of my couple of my founders, and it wasn't an easy decision to come to. But I understood that what's today the Radar product represented was a fundamental shift in the market from reactive, damaging attacks to preventative, no damaging attacks. It was a fundamental transformation of because what we understood in the early alpha is that we so profoundly changed the efficacy of the automated protection that was working, that this was really a fundamental shift. You'd be crazy once you understand what this does not to have this. You'd almost be irresponsible. In fact, you look at this data, you see, okay, look, I'm wide open here. My automated protection works on average, like let's say 60% of the time. And once you've reconfigured it based on the vulnerability data we provided, it was like operating at over 98% of it. So I understood very quickly that this was a fundamental shift. And I knew that if we're going to be creating a fundamental shift in the market, there's going to be many, many challenges. Many challenges. Some we foresaw, some we didn't. And we won't be able to do both. Because what we're telling the market is this old way of doing things is an old way. You think of it like the first generation. If you want to step up to the second generation and almost complete elimination of the possibility of ever having a damaging attack, you have to go in this direction. There is no in between.
So you needed to lead by example, effectively. You had to drink your own Kool-Aid.
Correct. We had to say, you know, and like I said, that decision didn't come easily because it was very difficult. We had very lucrative contracts with some very nice sized enterprises. And unfortunately, when you make such a transition, when you're a first mover product of a product that's never been done before in that industry, a true first mover, even your buyers and your existing customers are sometimes not the same buyer now for the new product. And some of them may not have the appetite to actually take such a product. So you had to cut. You couldn't do the slow transition. It was like, you know, either you come with us or we're going to part. Right. It was one of the toughest decisions I ever had to make in the company, but we did that, and that's what we did. And
looking back, do you feel it was the right decision to make?
Absolutely. You had to do that. There is no, if you're going to go up against a mindset in the market that you have to change minds of how the market should be operating, you have to cut the old way of doing things. And that's what we did.
Right.
Right.
Okay. So just then going back briefly to what we were talking about before. So having made that or knowing that shift was coming, okay, in early 21, okay, in the run-up to that, talk me through how you built the team, how you determined, okay, we're no longer going to be a service. Maybe you knew that at the time, maybe you didn't, but we're building out now a software team. We're going to need all of the resources that we don't necessarily have to build out a software team. Everything and building software is very different to delivering services. Okay, so what changes did you make internally to yourself from being the CEO of a services team to the CEO of a software team, okay, or a software company? And how did you determine the people that you needed to bring in?
Okay. So obviously I came from the enterprise space. You know, I've been in Checkpoint, I've been in Radware. I think I've got a knack for business, for sales. You know, when I was both in Checkpoint, or I'd say more in Radware and in Corrigan, but you very often found yourself selling, even though you weren't really a salesperson. So I had an inclination for the selling part, for getting people to try my stuff. But obviously, I think the most difficult thing, first of all, it was a dramatic change. I lost both my founders at the time that started the original company with me. I had to change personnel in some cases because they were no longer, they didn't suit the new direction. They didn't want to adapt to the new direction of where the company was going. We obviously also had to worry about the financial side of things, which you have to have very solid shareholders to support you through that, or be venture backed. In our case, it was through private shareholders. Plus, we had a nice services company where we had some cash reserve. And you have a lot more planning to do in terms of the finances all of a sudden, a lot more planning because you've got to expand the team. We went from 7 to 15 to 20, you know, so we today we're at around 35. So you've got to plan, you know, the financial track moving forward, who's going to be financing all of that. You've got to also plan, as you mentioned, the people. So when you're a smaller company, a startup, I think any startup, you know, whether you're services, or, but especially in more of the product, you've got to be able to get very talented resources in, they've got to be very effective, very committed to the company, very committed. You want people that are committed, and you don't necessarily always want the most experienced guy. You want guys that are going to grow rapidly and be able to mentor these people quickly. And I think you can guess it means at the beginning a lot of very long hours. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and those hours, by the way, never change. So you know, you've got to be ready to mentor people. You've got to streamline the training processes in the company. For instance, when you're onboarding a new R&D team, you're not going to go find 5 new senior software developers and an architect, and you know, let's bring in a CTO, and we'll bring in a couple of QA guys. It doesn't work like that. You've got to find super talented people. You've got to be able to have a recruitment process that does that, which I'm sure you're very familiar with, Simon.
A little bit.
And unfortunately, you can't normally work with the recruiters because they're so expensive.
But we're perfect.
So you've also got to recruit the people manually because you're obviously very budget conscious. And so there's first of all, the recruitment process, we know it even today as having a very very lengthy recruitment process in the company. So we established, for instance, you know, the multi-layered recruitment process. First, you're going to screen the candidates like anyone does, check that they're suitable. Then have an initial call with them to see that, you know, that everything sounds like a good fit on the phone. Then bring them in for a very complex technical test that in the early days was mainly technical roles when you're only essentially interviewing mainly R&D people and technical people to support this. And then we had a very strong practical test that we knew that those people would not be able to accomplish easily without going and doing a lot of research to accomplish those tests. So essentially, a really grueling recruitment process to validate that you're going to get someone in that's going to really be committed to the company and be able to produce at that high rate that you need. Then, on top of the recruitment process, you need to make sure that you've got a training process in place. And it needs to be a training process that you don't want to train each person one by one. So then you need to put in a training system. So then you have a training system where you streamline that process that you train. So from the very beginning in Maysbold, we established a lot of those processes, kind of like enterprise processes, but for a startup. Mm-hmm. So investing an incredible amount on the infrastructure that when someone comes in, they've got the training modules for R&D, that a lot of that work is accomplished, that you don't have the head of R&D spending your time only mentoring someone. A lot of that training is done individually.
Right.
So putting that training process in was critical. Maintaining a good DNA in the company, putting a set of values out for the company is also very important. So
right.
We did that too very early on. We wanted to make sure, you know, that you've got the right kind of people that are going to fit in your company. That's a really crucial part. Want, you know, honesty, discipline. You want people that are focused and committed to the company.
And particularly when your company is sort of like 15, 20, now you say 35 people.
Right.
One bad apple is going to do a lot more damage in a company that size than it would be at, say, IBM or Microsoft, where there's
correct
hundreds of thousands of people, you know.
Correct. And maintaining that is a real challenge. And that all starts with the recruitment process.
Mm-hmm.
Someone might be very bright, but you know what? This is going to, as you said, this is going to destabilize the entire team. And we had that along the way. And we had to let those people go because it just kind of ruins the entire company.
Right.
So maintaining the DNA is critical. Keeping to your core values in the company is very important. Keeping the objective in mind with everyone in the company is also very important, what those goals are. Very early on in the company, we had goals set out quarterly, even monthly sometimes. So, you know, just depending on what stage we were at, you have to adapt to, as you grow, you know, expand those processes, refine those processes. But we do put a lot of emphasis on the process. I think that's one thing that we've done early on. We knew this is a very robust, very complex product. So if you didn't have that kind of discipline from the R&D to the marketing, to the sales, their interaction between the departments, we got an HR very early on in the company. I'm a very strong believer in the HR of the company.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it maps back to the DNA of the company and making sure. So watching all kind of those soft aspects of the company and not just the raw execution of the company, which is also very important. Everybody needs to get to numbers that are attainable, but we need to make sure we're going in that direction. You need to watch constantly that you've got the right people, and you have to make changes along the way when those people are not suitable anymore to move forward.
Right, that's great. So what three tips would you have for somebody who wants to follow your footsteps and maybe they've identified a problem and are looking to build a company around the solution? What three tips would you give to them?
First of all, you have to be persistent. If you're not persistent, don't try to do it. You're wasting your time. It's not, no matter how easy you think it's going to be, it's not going to be a walk in the park ever. So you've got to be persistent. You've got to have a plan. You have to have a plan. You have to know that this is, and be prepared for that plan to change, but at least have a plan. That plan, it will change. Your plan will change. Update your plan. Make sure your plan is updated, but have a plan, follow the plan, have a strategic plan, have short-term goals, have a strategic plan, but have a plan. And you need good shareholders and a good board / financial backing in the company. You've got to make sure that you are part of your plan is making sure how you're going to keep this machine funded until everything can fund itself, kind of thing. So You've got to have it goes back to the plan, but having a strong board and good shareholders, it's critical, because you can't do everything yourself. You have to, and again, and another, obviously, you said three tips, I would have four tips. You've got to have a strong team around you. You've got to have a strong team around you. Management is very important. You've got to be able to rely on your management, and you've got to be uncompromising with your management. But you've got to have strong management around you. You've got to be able to rely on them. Otherwise, it's very clear that as you move forward, if there's a manager you cannot rely on, that will be a part of the company that's not succeeding. And you're going to have to make changes and move forward. But your management is a direct part of you. So right. That's very important.
Right. Okay, great stuff. And what's next for you and for Maysbolt?
We're expanding. I think in the next few years, you'll see very few enterprise organizations that don't have a Maysbolt deployment, a radar deployment for their DDoS protection. We are also expanding our product line in terms of right now there's a focus on DDoS, but we've got some exciting stuff coming out in machine learning that we've been working on for the past 18 months, somewhere around there. We've got a lot of exciting stuff coming up, and we've got we've got a lot planned for the future, and I think you'll see it. You'll see it. You'll see us a lot. We've got more relationships planned in the future, more strategic relationships planned, like similar to what we have with F5, but in different areas. We are expanding our channel relationships in the company, because these are the people that are most connected to our customers. And that's where our big focus is right now, really just expanding.
Great stuff. It's exciting.
And of course, we're there to deliver the top DDoS security possible to our customers. We want to make sure any customer with a radar deployment completely prevents any damaging attack and doesn't rely on kind of damaging SLAs and response teams. You want to have complete damage prevention. So that's what we're doing.
Great stuff. And if you wanted to learn more about you or about Maysbolt, what's the best way for them to do that?
Go to maysbolt.com. Go to maysbolt.com and you can learn a lot about us. Go to blog.maysbolt.com. We've got lots of interesting blogs there. We've got a lot of interesting research there. So go to maysbolt.com. That is the best place to go.
Great stuff. And I'll make sure there's a link to both maysbolt.com and also the blog in the show notes. In the meantime, Matthew Andreani, this has just been an amazing, amazing conversation. I've just learned so much, not just about DDoS protection, which I mean, I knew what those four letters were, but that was about it. But also how you went from coming up with an idea, developing the technology, and also that shift that you made from being a services company to being a software company, and the bravery that it took to kind of double down on that. It was just an incredible, incredible story. And I'm so grateful that you've shared it with us. So Matthew Andreani, thank you so much for coming in and talking to us here in the conference room.
Thank you, Simon. Thank you very much. Great conversation. Thank you.
Coming up next week on the conference room, I'll be talking to business consultant and fractional COO, Lauren Goldstein.
Generally, when you start a business, you've got this skill set, you've seen the problems, you know you can solve it. And so you start doing all the things. And what that creates is business verticals and a very reactive business, because you're responding to other people, to other problems, etc. And you haven't actually taken a breath since starting and said, okay, let's pause for a minute and let's proactively figure out where we're going.
Thanks so much for listening. We really appreciate it. And make sure you visit our website, theconferenceroompodcast.com, to see all the other episodes and to get access to the show notes and resources mentioned in this episode. If you enjoyed the episode, please share it with your network, or better still, go on to Apple Podcasts or Spotify or any other podcast platform and leave us a 5-star review. It'll only take you a moment, but it'll mean the world to us. And please don't hesitate to tell us which topics you'd like us to cover in future episodes. To get in touch, drop us a line in the comments section or send us a message on social media. Just search for The Conference Room Podcast or me, Simon Lader, on Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, or TikTok. I'm always open to a conversation. And don't forget to hit that subscribe button so you'll be alerted when a new episode goes live every week. Thanks so much for listening to The Conference Room, and until next time, keep talking.